and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, September 30th, 2022. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, Stephen Wenzel sits down with Joshua Whitehead, First Nations Two-Spirit author of Making Love with the Land. Whitehead is an Oji-Cree, Niowa, Two-Spirit, Indigiqueer member of Pegas First Nation, Treaty 1 Territory. He is the author of Johnny Appleseed, which was longlisted for the Scotiabank Giller Prize and shortlisted for a Governor General's Literary Award in fiction. He is also the author of the poetry collection Full Metal Indigiqueer, which was shortlisted for the inaugural Indigenous Voices Award for Most Significant Work of Poetry in English and the Stephen G. Stevenson Award for Poetry. Currently, he is working on a PhD in Indigenous Literatures and Cultures at the University of Calgary's English Department on Treaty 7 territory. Today, Whitehead joins Wenzel to talk about Making Love with the Land, a book which is part memoir, part poetry, part literary criticism. Whitehead explains how this genre bending of traditional colonial literary standards is a radical act of freedom, and more similar to an Indigenous form of storytelling. Whitehead also shares how touring for Johnny Appleseed and experiencing nature, breakups, and isolation during the COVID-19 pandemic influenced his writing this book. Finally, Whitehead shares what truth and reconciliation means to him. Here are Whitehead and Wenzel in conversation. Take a listen.
To get started, your book's been out for about a month now. I'm wondering, what's the response been like?
The response has been pretty wild, actually. So Making Love with the Land was just nominated on Wednesday for the Hilary Weston Writers Trust Nonfiction Award, which I am like flabbergasted about still. I've just been so busy teaching that I really haven't had time to take it all in. So that's my plan this weekend, a small little celebration with some friends and some bubbles. But the reception overall has been actually quite profound. I was doing the tour, and I'm still doing the tour virtually and in person through a hybrid model. But just like in the Q&As, both in virtual and in-person spaces and the book signings, people have been coming up to me and really kind of expressing their gratitude, really, for this book, which deals heavily with mental health, but also Indigeneity and queerness and that kind of that triage right there. And yeah, people have just been coming up to me to say, like, you know, I've never heard someone express, you know, an eating disorder in this way, or talk about anxiety or insomnia in this form. So yeah, a lot of gratitude and thanks from folks who are, I think, finding their own time and their own ways of coming to terms or expressing or even naming, the ways in which they might be struggling with mental health and how it has been so exacerbated through COVID. I think we're all in a small sense dented or fractured. And so I think it's an important time to be talking about this topic.
So Making Love with the Land, it's a beautiful title for a book. I'm wondering, how did you come to choose that name for the book?
When we were doing the cover of this, there was different cover options. One had like a tiger on it for some reason. I don't know why a tiger was being tropical themes for a book that's prairie centric. But when we were coming to the cover design, my editor, Lynn Henry, was like, well, we need to just like make sure that the title is the cover page, because the title is kind of the selling point and everyone loved it so much. And how I came to Making Love with the Land is actually through Johnny Appleseed, my novel. I kind of call all my books sibling stories. So when I was touring with Johnny Appleseed, there's a scene in that book in which Johnny has this dream where this bear is visiting him in the mountains, and they kind of have this Marian Engel style sexual bear encounter, I suppose I would say. But the kind of the opening of that scene has this moment where Johnny, the titular character, is, you know, in the mountains. This was in Banff when I was finishing writing that novel. And he's just noticing spring and, like, you know, the kind of the flowering and the renewal of life and the kind of the greening again of things that have dead and passed and things that are coming out of the thaw. and expresses, and I quote, the land was horny as fuck. And because that's every time I was touring with Johnny, people would request me to read the bear scene, which just like blows my mind that I guess Canadian literature readers are very much into like bestiality. So yeah, I was kind of coming to Making Love with the Land. There's a line in Johnny too, which was the motor, I think, of this book, in which his cuckum or his grandmother teaches him that humility is just a humiliation that you loved so much it transformed. And I remember like when I was beginning to write Making Love with the Land, I was like, who the hell wrote that line? Like, I don't remember writing that line. It's funny how characters can continue to teach you. And so I was like working on this book during the touring of Johnny and afterwards, and really thinking about what's the title that I want to entitle this book. And so I returned to, you know, that beloved scene that everyone loves and was like, oh, there's a title right there. Thank you, Johnny, in your kind of your maybe crude but appropriate ruminations on how the land is always making in relation and making love. So Making Love with the Land was born from that.
Wonderful. And so the book is a series of essays, a collection of essays. And I'm wondering if you had to take a different approach to writing this book than, say, Johnny Appleseed or a collection of poetry.
Very much. With this book, I kind of call it the behind the scenes of Johnny Appleseed, but also a Full Metal too. It kind of came from touring with both of those books and, you know, Q&As and inquisitions and queries that, you know, audience members and interviewers would have alike, in which they would confuse me profoundly, Johnny as Joshua and Joshua as Johnny. That also began happening in my real life. Making Love with the Land began to be written after a long-term relationship was broken up. And so, you know, I moved back into kind of the modes of queer and queer desire. And I also started to get, maybe this was because Johnny was becoming so popularized at the time, and even more so after Canada Reads, but was starting to get confused as Johnny in the bedroom as well. So I was like, what's happening here? And naturally, this book kind of came from really ponderings and queries for myself and quandaries about, okay, like what is happening with this kind of fusion of the authorial I, the pronoun I, and the book that's being crafted, and kind of the autobiographical pact that seems to be inherently soldered to a work of fiction or a book of poetry, specifically by like BIPOC folks, you know, from folks who might be curious and wanting to be better allies and inherently read books by BIPOC and or queer folks that are fiction as nonfiction. And so Making Love with the Land was actually just a real practice in self-care, primarily during COVID. In which the majority of it was being written, in that I wanted to kind of journal, really, as my therapist was telling me at the time. And the journals became essays, and I was asking myself, because it was just me talking with myself on the page, asking myself questions of things that I might have repressed for so, so long, like sexual assault, but also, you know, body dysmorphia. And I gave myself the allowance to speak freely on these topics because it was just a practice in journaling, really, and a practice in kind of an exorcism, really, I guess. And lo and behold, I was like, these are essays. And you know, it's primarily during the lockdown periods of COVID, I thought it was paramount that I really, you know, as a decolonialist who is indigenous, but also a queer person who advocates for mental health, that I put my money where my mouth is. And I thought the best way that I can do that is to actually take these journals, and it became essays, and compile them into something, and to really take the mask of character off on stage and, you know, stand in a 10 essay monologue, really, and bear it all in the hopes that, you know, with the social capital that I have now, the limited amount that I have now, that it would allow folks to also come to terms or put language to things that might be buried unconsciously.
Now, in your book, you talk about what makes a memoir. And I'm wondering where you feel your book lies on this spectrum, perhaps, of memoir. And can you talk a bit about the voyeuristic aspect of autobiography that you captured so well in your book?
Yeah, in the middle of the book, there is an essay called Writing is a Rupture. And it's like aesthetically also ruptures the book with these gray pages. I think the second half of the book is what we might call more traditional memoir, in that, you know, I'm detailing, you know, loved ones in my life, that ex-partner who's actually now one of my good friends as well, my aunties, and, you know, the writing process in Golden, BC, also with a previous partner as well. But I think the first half is more literary criticism, maybe more autofiction than the last half is. And then the middle section, which is writing as a rupture, I think is just full on genre criticism. And I think how I still want to categorize this book. again, with the Hilary Weston award, I'm like, yes, it's nonfiction, but it's also not. It's also poetry. It's also prosaic. It's criticism. It's confession. It's intertextual. It's kind of musical, I'd say, and the kind of all the plethora of musical references that are being put in and throughout. And at the end of the day, as I write in the book, I think for me, it's just a natural way of thinking. Like, Making Love with the Land is a visual and oral representation of my mental processes, I think, and thinking in fractures and thinking in vignettes and stitching together them all, past, present, and future, always interweaving. So I think at the end of the day, I just kind of call it a story in an indigenous perspective, in that story sounds basic and simple in English, but within, you know, Nehiyawewin or Cree Otachi, actually details things such as like legend speakers and storiers and people who would practice in the traditional law practices of the Cree, as well as interviewers, people who would practice in rhetoric. And so it captures all of these things. And it was like, that is like all genre and no genre at the same time. And I think for me, I was like, story works the best because it's indefinable and undescribable by the nation states, that is English and its language. And I think that is like a radical act of freedom right there, to be unknowable and undefinable to the colonial tongue. So I very much enjoy that. But of course, for the sake of publishing and publicity and sales, it has to be given monikers of genre. But at the end of the day, yeah, it's like, if I am going to be decolonial on the land, I need to do it on the page as well.
No, that's very important. And I just want to reference early on in your book, you wrote something that maybe to listeners might sound kind of simple, but it's truly profound. You wrote that I own a body worth owing. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you meant by that.
Yeah, I think, you know, as Indigenous folks who are queer or two-spirit, with under heteropatriarchy and late stage capitalism and neo-traditionalism within our own Indigenous communities, we are told and we are made to believe that, you know, we are ghastly. We're always ghosted to the past. Two-spirit people were revered. So we never have an embodied sense of being. We never have a physical body, but the historical body of two-spiritness is so ephemeral. And on the same aspect, you know, under a racist regime that's colonial as well, Indigenous peoples are disembodied, you know, within desire. And so I can speak like in terms of queer desire, you know, with dating applications such as like Tinder and Hinge and Grindr, they actually have weird identifying categories in which you can say Native American. And then you get so exoticized as well, which is a primary component of why I wrote Johnny Appleseed. And so the body is never embodied. And the body, again, the physical body, but our bodies of land and our bodies of water too are always excavated and, you know, deemed unnecessary and only for the sake of profit. And for lack of a better word, like raped in terms of the land, right? The bodies of land and the bodies of water. And so in writing, I own a body that's worth owing. I feel as if this is a way to like not make it in terms of ownership, but in terms of like returning our body and all the bodies that we're in relationship with, bodies of land, bodies of water, bodies of text, back into a web of relations rather than as fractured things. And I think at the end of the day, it just comes back to me. I think a problem that I and so many folks that I have spoken with while writing this, and just as kin and friends who are BIPOC or Indigenous and are queer, have kind of come to this conclusion and are working our way out of it, that, you know, our body is a border between the world and us rather than a vehicle, which I think is a normalized way of being, that the body is made to be a vehicle for experience and sensation. Whereas for me, I'd always kind of felt like a border between self and world. So I personally wanted to owe that body, which is mine, and shatter down that wall or that border, and let myself become free into the hinterlands of sensations and living, really, which I think is a very powerful decolonial tactic to take upon.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's an act of resistance, right? And when we think of resistance as a spectrum, it definitely is an important one. So Friday is the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation. And something that an elder told me a couple of years ago that really stuck with me is kind of the trouble with the word reconciliation, because when we think of reconciling, we're thinking of two parties who both need to hold themselves accountable for wrongdoing. And so maybe, at least for this person, they weren't sure if reconciliation might be the right term to describe kind of what she was hoping for. But I'm wondering, as we celebrate the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, what does reconciliation mean to you? And what does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that elder as well. But I also see its importance, like when the Pope visited in Northern Alberta and across the island, at least the northern part that is Canada. There was a lot of outrage from Indigenous folks, but there was also a lot of healing, I would say, that was done on the parts of survivors of those schools to be given an apology from a figurehead of those places. And I can speak personally from family members of mine who are survivors of that school, were overcome, not so much as, okay, it's finished, but in getting a personal apology that was mending for them, hopefully for them to kind of start more into their healing journey. And with reconciliation and with Orange Shirt Day coming up, I also there's that prefix of re and conciliation. There's we never had conciliatory actions. We never had conciliatory relationships. So it seems redundant to have that prefix and to even thinking about reconciliation, because there never was a space in which time was, or that unity was at play, right? And so for reconciliation for me, I think what it means and what I want it to be, I don't think that's the correct term to be using. I think what the term is, I don't think it's my place to make. But what I would like to see is literal action being done to give land back to Indigenous peoples. And I know it sounds terrifying to settlers, and Indigenous peoples are not asking everyone to vacate and leave. But the land back is, again, when given to Indigenous peoples, it's not about ownership of that land, thereby you must vacate, but rather reconceptualizing our relationships with the land, specifically in this kind of global economic and ecological crises that we're in. There's hurricanes, as you were noting as well. Puerto Rico is completely dammed right now. There's Wet'suwet'en is still going on. Fairy Creek is happening. And, we are witnessing heat waves across the prairies of temperatures we haven't seen in ages, and droughts in Saskatchewan. And so everything is on fire and ruined, and we're on the brink of World War III. And I think I would like to kind of see it come back to a web of connection and relations that is about stewardship and about mending and rejuvenating this land that's, capitalism and settler colonization has completely sped up the register towards a doomsday clock, and to stop it and to rejuvenate it. And I think we saw that when we took stasis in the lockdowns of COVID, in which, there was, I think, two things that we saw happen, which I think might be the silver lining. And I hope that's something that we can take as we move forward within, and maybe one day outside of this pandemic, is that the memes that were going around, but it was actually very truthful that, the world is healing. We saw dolphins return to Venice, and, we saw rejuvenation and we saw renewal. And at the same time, when we were all locked down, the real only thing that we had outside of FaceTiming people getting quickly burnt out on the virtual was to go outside and to go on walks, and remembering how lonely and desolate and intimacy and touch starved we were. When we went on those walks and we went outside and reconnected with the lands that we are either from or guest to, I think what we consciously or unconsciously came to realize is that when we went outside to that lake, or we went on that trail, or we listened to that bird song, we realized that we were never really alone in a kind of fundamental sense. Personal sense, yes, but fundamentally, no. because we were in a huge web of relations. It was, we were very much, we all were making love with the land. We heard birdsong, you know, we felt a touch of wind on our skin. We felt the sun and we felt the snow. And I think we were all so grateful to be back outside and on the land in those moments. And I think we so quickly forgot that again. So yeah, I guess I would say land back in a sense of returning to relationship and remembering the relationships that we had and that maintained us when we were locked down and completely starved of everything.
And so just to bring this all back full circle, one question I always ask authors, and it's sometimes a stumper, but it's an important one. I'm wondering, you know, your book taught me so much, but I'm wondering what you learned from writing the book.
It is a bit of a stumper, right? So I was actually supposed to be at TIFA, Toronto International Festival of Authors, at the end of the month. And I'm also teaching full-time right now. You know, I'm helping work on a screenplay for Johnny Appleseed. I have grad students and I'm touring. And I have a long-distance partner right now. I have a full-time job with my German Shepherd dog. So I have very limited energy. I have a large reserve of energy as I write in Making Love with the Land. I have this like mutant ability to always energize myself. But I'm learning the kind of, as I age more and more, I'm learning the kind of limitations of that. And I'm also, I was so adamant about saying no in this book that like on the page, it was theoretically, it was like done, right? Like point blank finished. But Joshua as a writer also really, I think is still such, is very accommodating to expand myself for the sake of, you know, helping others, be it through sharing story or be it through proximity. And so I was supposed to be at TIFA, and then unfortunately I had to cancel it and switch some of them to virtual or just outright cancel because I was just exhausted. So I think what the book is teaching me now and what past Josh is teaching this Josh in this moment is kind of the radical power of rejection and the kind of the freeing and healing ability of no. Again, I'm sure, I hope many people realize this and use this with Orange Shirt Day coming up, but sometimes rejection is a motor for creation. What rejection teaches me is to either enhance my practice creatively or enhance my practice for self-care and self-embetterment. So I think Making Love with the Land really taught me and is still teaching me how to be a better rejector.
Yeah, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to chat. It's Joshua Whitehead, Making Love with the Land. It's available now in bookstores and online.
That was a conversation between Joshua Whitehead, author of Making Love with the Land, and Rabble's own Stephen Wenzel. Thanks so much for that, Josh and Stephen. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. Here to catch you up on all of the news of the week on Rabble.ca, here's editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week at Rabble, our staff is mourning the loss of Bill Blakey, former New Democratic MP, columnist for Rabble, and friend. Rabble parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg remembers Blakey as an advocate for the working class and outlined the mark Blakey left on Canadian politics. Blakey highlighted that being outside of government doesn't mean that someone cannot wield real power. From the NDP seats in the House of Commons, Blakey fought for issues like healthcare with persistence and passion. Blakey fiercely fought for the protection of Canada's universal healthcare system and pressured the Liberal government of Pierre Trudeau to end the practice of double billing with their Canada Health Act of 1984. Nirenberg writes, quote, "The act bears then Health Minister Monique Béguin's name, but Béguin herself would likely tell you that were it not for Bill Blakey, we might very well not have had the Canada Health Act, and our healthcare system might look very different than it does today," end quote. Also in Canadian politics, I covered Pierre Poilievre's recent response to threats made against his family by far-right extremists Jeremy McKenzie and Alex Vriend. Vriend and McKenzie are leaders of Diagonalon, a far-right organization aimed at establishing a white nationalist state running diagonally from Alaska through Canada to the southern U.S. The two men recently spoke on a vlog about performing sexually explicit acts on Poilievre's wife Anita as a, quote, power move, end quote. Poilievre took to Twitter on Monday, September 26, denouncing McKenzie and Diagonalon as dirtbags and losers. This was not Poilievre's first encounter with a hate group, however. In late August, Poilievre was photographed shaking hands with McKenzie at a campaign event, and when the photo began to circulate on social media, Poilievre refused to denounce McKenzie directly. The RCMP stated that they will be investigating the alleged threats made by McKenzie towards Polyev's wife. The RCMP arrested McKenzie in Halifax on Thursday, September 28th, on a Canada-wide warrant stemming from weapons charges laid in Saskatchewan in July. Also on the site this week, our Off the Hill political panel series returned with an all-Indigenous panel answering the question, what does reconciliation look like? Our panel explored the role media plays in truth and reconciliation, how Indigenous peoples are exercising sovereignty every day, and what action must be taken at the federal and provincial levels for meaningful change. The panel featured guests MP Leigh Gazan, Brienne Lavallee-Heckert, and Georgina Lazor. Co-hosted by Robin Brown and Libby Davies. If you missed the panel, you can catch the full video on Rabble's YouTube channel or on Rabble TV. This week in labor news, columnist Thomas Sanborn outlines the case of Danilo De Leon, a temporary foreign worker in Canada who's now facing the threat of deportation. Sanborn, who's covered migrant worker issues for over a decade, also outlines in this piece Canada's cumbersome and structurally racist system in place for temporary workers seeking permanent resident status in Canada. He's also covered the pattern of deaths, illnesses, and injuries for migrant workers. Sanborn writes, quote, "We eat the food foreign workers plant and harvest, and they are often the ones providing us with life-saving care when we age and fall sick. We owe them for all they do for us, and we owe them, in all decency, active solidarity when they ask for a fair deal." End quote. Finally, Stephen Wentzel interviewed author Leslie Kern about her new book, Gentrification is Inevitable and Other Lies. In her book, Kern describes the impact gentrification has on low-income neighborhoods and ways that communities can organize to fight back. An excerpt from the book reads, quote, "By portraying the neighborhood as damaged, abandoned, and dirty, the changes brought by gentrification come to seem as necessary, good, and welcome. Describing the neighborhood as a place in need of saving makes gentrification a hero." End quote. To read the full version of these stories and much, much more, visit rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Finally, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. Special shout out to the listeners at Axe Radio in Wolfville, Nova Scotia this week. To everyone tuning in to Rabble Radio over at Acadia University, special hello to you. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.